Welcome to our Global Expansion podcast series. Today, we will be talking about the United Arab Emirates and specifically about the Dubai International Financial Center, or DIFC. I'm Anna Malivato, a partner in Schulte's London office. My practice is focused on investment manager regulatory compliance. I'm here with my colleague, Jake Haker, who works in our investment management group and is based in New York. We're very fortunate today to have two great speakers. Both are very well known for their expertise in the region. Claire Curtis is the founder of Effector Compliance. She brings to this role over 20 years of regulatory compliance expertise in the Middle East and the United Kingdom. Effector aims to deliver a more bespoke compliance service, or what they like to call an in-house version of compliance support, to a variety of asset management groups and other types of investment firms that operate globally. Ali Hassan is a senior representative for the DIFC Authority in Europe and North America. He's also a senior vice president for the DIFC, responsible for business development. Ali brings vast regulatory knowledge and commercial experience to his role. Over the course of his career as a regulator, he has supervised and been responsible for authorizing a diverse range of businesses, from exchanges and trading platforms to wealth management, investment banking, and brokerage operations.
Ali, are you seeing a significant interest from US and European managers in the UAE and in the DIFC?
Hi, Jake. In a word, yes. I mean, in fact, since the creation of the DIFC, we've seen maintained interest in Dubai and the wider region from US and European managers. In fact, the UK and US are our top two incoming markets, as well as other financial services firms, of course, and professional service providers. And I think that that's because the economic benefits and opportunities of having a local presence have become more compelling as the years have passed, with the DIFC as the destination of choice, offering a conducive location with international standards of law and regulation, combined with business-friendly aspects around ownership, employment, and taxation. So today, after 20 years of development, the DIFC stands as a credible global financial center. It's ranked number one in the MEASA region, which is Middle East, Africa, South Asia, with over 42,000 people, 5,000 companies, with a depth in all the financial segments. And in terms of comparison, it's 5x to 10x the size of anything else in the region, depending upon the financial segment that you look at. Turning to asset and wealth management, that is a significant part of the community. Over 400 firms are active in the center in that particular segment. The original focus of those firms, going back to our creation in 2004, was, of course, asset raising, predominantly from the sovereign wealth funds of the region. But now we've seen that evolve to engage the considerable private wealth pools that are also present in the region, and for which Dubai is the most concentrated cluster. So this long-term trend of asset raising continues, with long-only or traditional asset managers such as the likes of Wellington, AllianceBernstein, and Lord Abbott recently entering the DIFC, adapting their business models to have investor relations, business development people based locally in the DIFC. Another more recent trend we have seen has been with hedge funds setting up in the DIFC for asset raising, yes, but actually more to house portfolio managers. So for hedge fund managers, it's become a talent retention and acquisition play to offer Dubai and the DIFC as a location, as portfolio managers themselves increasingly recognize the positive aspects of being based in Dubai. So the trading time zone seems to be developing as a new hub for Asia, the quality of the lifestyle, the global city attributes, and the taxation. So there are now 40 hedge funds licensed in the DIFC. There are 20 in the pipeline with a reasonable prospect, I think, of 70 or so active by the end of 2024. The initial strategies we saw were multi-strat, multi-manager, but we are now seeing very much the single CIO model active and across the different investment strategies. So global macro, equity long short, emerging market, quantitative, credit, with fund sizes ranging from sub 1 billion to the multiple tens of billions. Moreover, we're also now seeing spin outs and new managers establishing in the DIFC. And all of this has been very much driven by business needs and opportunities and the talent that's involved. Finally, other areas of alternatives are also responding to investor demand and the regional economic development initiatives that we're seeing in the region. So in relation to the former, private credit seems to be a strategy of interest to particularly institutional managers. And in the latter, in relation to the latter, private equity, venture capital, and real estate managers are also coming into the DIFC.
Thanks, Ali. That sounds like an excellent snapshot of what's going on. And it seems not a day goes by that we don't hear about another manager setting up in UAE. And of course, UAE is not a single jurisdiction. Ali was talking about primarily about DIFC, but of course, there are other jurisdictions within UAE. Claire, could you give us some background on how it works and what the different jurisdictions are and how they operate together?
Sure, Anna. It's normally one of the first questions we get asked by our clients is, we want to come to the UAE, but where in the UAE do we actually go? And having been there for such a long time, some things that become very obvious to us are not always obvious to those that are coming in. So, for instance, just to give you an overview, the UAE is made up of seven emirates. And in those emirates, we have things that are called free zones, financial free zones, and we also have something that we call onshore. So just to have a look at how it all kind of works together, if you look at the UAE as a whole, most of the original financial services were what's called onshore. So that is outside of a free zone or a financial free zone. And in those instances, most of the time you'd have to actually have a local sponsor. And that local sponsor would own sort of 51% of your business. And it was very much there to service the domestic market, if you will, so quite retail heavy. Since then, as you can imagine, international firms have been coming in and they don't really want to have 51% of their business owned by a local sponsor. And then these things called free zones were established. Now, when we start looking at free zones, these are actually different to a financial free zone, which is what we're talking about for DIFC and also for the Abu Dhabi equivalent of ADGM. And a free zone is really an area designated for you to set up a business which doesn't require that kind of 51% local ownership or local sponsorship. So a lot of foreign firms would set up there, but not always in the financial sector, mainly because a lot of the financial sector like to be quite comfortable with the regulatory and legal environment of a Middle East country. And this is really where DIFC and ADGM have come into play, in the fact that they have their own regulatory regime, their own regulators, and they also have their own legal regime. So, and this is in respect of civil and commercial matters. So as you can imagine, the criminal federal law still applies, which is relevant when we talk about things like AML. But from, let's say, the perspective of corporate law or employment law, they actually have their own laws in those relevant financial free zones, very much based or even incorporating UK legal practices. So it becomes an area that's very familiar then for especially UK firms to understand regulatory and legal environment. And therefore, when we're talking to firms, it tends to be that those are the two jurisdictions that they're interested in. And then it's a further conversation about exactly how they're looking to set up and what they're going to do as to whether Abu Dhabi Global Markets or the Dubai International Financial Centre is the better place for them. But that does come down to firm by firm.
Thanks, Claire. That's very helpful and interesting to sort of see that there's a broader applicability potentially to the UAE as a whole, and that ADGM has been developing in parallel. Though back to Ali specifically about DIFC, we know the DFSA has developed over recent years, but could you give us a bit of an overview about how the DFSA has evolved and how, in particular, how does the DIFC regulatory regime compare to ADGM or other UAE jurisdictions?
Sure, Jake. I think it's worth bearing in mind in all of this, and it touches upon some of the points Claire made as well, is that from the very outset, DFSA's guiding, overriding objective, if you like, is to be first and foremost an independent, internationally credible financial regulator. And that's very much informed its approach throughout the 20 years, and it informs its approach to policy development. So as Claire mentioned, the DFSA's starting point was the UK regulatory regime. So for any asset manager coming to the DIFC from established markets, the regulations and approach will be familiar. However, on top of that, it has used practical judgment when deciding what international initiatives it should also adopt. And it has taken into account a lot of context and risks. So, for example, the DFSA did not adopt the more prescriptive approach to pay and bonuses post the financial crisis that we saw in the European Union. The DFSA has also looked to facilitate new business models. And of course, innovation is playing a key part in that. We have a significant innovation community in the DIFC, innovating across financial services, including wealth and asset management. So it was actually the first in the region to put out a comprehensive regime for crowdfunding, for payments, and indeed for digital assets. Firstly, investment tokens, and then more recently for crypto. And with the approach to crypto, it's quite interesting. I mean, I think that the DFSA has been very transparent. So it's put out a very comprehensive regime. You have the regs there. You can see what the requirements are. But it's taken a cautious, prudent approach as well, mindful of the risks to the centre, firms, and indeed investors. So I think crypto is an interesting case study, which signifies the approach of the DFSA. They've also put in place a progressive regime for venture capital, adopting something quite similar to the regime in place in Singapore. And so, again, it's showing examples of pulling in best practice from around the world. And in fact, off the back of that VC regime, we now have over 30 venture capital firms in the DIFC with venture capital funds domiciled in the centre. The DFSA has also very much a regard for efficiency of process. And, for example, over the last 12 months, in response to the concerted demand from asset managers, DFSA has hired more talent, it's reviewed its processes, and application timelines have come down significantly. In terms of comparisons, it's quite interesting. I think DFSA and DIFC as a whole has actually, over the period of time, acted as an agent for change in the UAE, and indeed the wider region, with Qatar Financial Centre and Abu Dhabi Global Markets being on paper almost identical constructs. But in reality, there are some discernible differences. So, for example, you know, within the DIFC, the DFSA is very much the independent financial regulator and doesn't get involved in the business marketing side at all. And all the firms, so the 5,000 firms, the asset managers, have established organically in the DIFC without fear nor favour, with total business freedom. And I think these nuances are very important. And I think that it also lends itself to, you know, firms that are interested actually going to see and visit the UAE and the different centres there, and, you know, coming to a conclusion on that basis. And I'll leave it there.
Well, thank you for outlining these differences. And it does sound like DIFC compares favorably to some of the other zones in the region. But what about the marketing rules? And Claire, perhaps you could tell us about this. Are there differences? How do they work in the UAE generally? We see a lot of managers trying to go into UAE to market their funds as well as their services, such as managed accounts.
You're absolutely right, Anna. It's always been a focus of people coming to the UAE is to come in and, let's say, tap the wealth and actually go out and market and distribute funds, whether that be from a presence within the UAE or even from outside of the UAE. So when we start talking to firms about setting up and they look at their options, I think that they generally believe that because they've now set up an entity, let's say, in the DIFC, that now that they can go and market their funds throughout the UAE. And that's not exactly how it works. So because of the structure that we discussed with DIFC, ADGM being financial free zones, and then outside of those financial free zones is really governed by a separate regulator, mainly the Securities and Commodities Authority. And they therefore govern the client base or the potential client base that most firms are trying to attract. So when we actually set firms up, we first of all talk to them about the cross-border aspect of what they're doing, because they need to be aware that their license will allow them to do business in or from the financial free zone. But the likelihood is that their client base or potential investor base isn't actually in that financial free zone, although it might be, but a larger amount of them would actually be outside, which is onshore and therefore governed by a different regulatory regime. Now, ESCA is a bit more of a tricky regulator, if I can say that, in the fact that they do update their requirements and their policies. And a lot of the time, it's really there to very much protect the local markets. So we have seen a lot of movement in and questions around the ability to market foreign funds. So this is an area that's still developing. You have to be aware that there is cross-border. So moving into, say, the sovereign wealth funds, they might fall into a certain exemption, but perhaps talking to family offices might not fall into that exemption. And therefore, you need to be aware what the local requirements are in marketing those funds and whether you need to then appoint a local distributor, whether you need to register your funds. All of these questions become very important. And this is where the interplay between all of the regulatory regimes becomes very interesting for us, but sometimes a bit more challenging for our clients to understand. So we really do look at what the type of fund is, who is it that they're marketing to, and working out if there is an exemption. So when we actually move forward with applications, people like yourselves and lawyers will become quite instrumental in getting firms to understand the restrictions around cross-border marketing and what that means in the UAE, because you would be mistaken to think that that's one country that you can therefore market throughout, whereas actually you need to be aware of other regulatory regimes. And even thinking slightly further afield, there is no GCC passport. So you always need to be aware of where your client is and where you're going to market to, as to whether you therefore need to look at partnering with a local distributor, whether you need to register your funds, or whether you can fall into an exemption, including things like reverse solicitation in those kind of limited circumstances where that sort of reverse solicitation actually works.
This is good to know. Ali, do you have any insights in terms of the direction of travel? And Claire mentioned that the policy is very much developing in the different jurisdictions within the UAE. Thoughts on this?
Yes, Anna. I mean, it is true that you do have to carefully consider what is the nature of your client and which locations, countries do you wish to cover. In reality, within the DIFC, those 400 wealth and asset management firms are active right across the region, not just in the UAE, but the wider Middle East and even into South Asia, Central Asia and Africa. But they do it, obviously, utilizing compliance advisory firms and law firms to make sure that they have the appropriate business model in place for each of those jurisdictions. In terms of the UAE, I mean, it's fast evolving. I mean, it's come a long way in financial services in a very short period of time. So there's still some elements that need to be smoothed out, if you like. But I think the way to look at the landscape, the regulatory landscape in the UAE, is that actually firms have got optionality within the country, that they can select a location within the UAE, be it DIFC, be it ADGM, or be it, and I don't really like onshore, offshore, but being outside the free zones, but within the UAE, and that will determine which regulator and which regulatory regime that the firm will fall under. As I've mentioned, and as Claire has pointed out as well, the DIFC and ADGM have very common origins, and therefore their regulatory regimes are fairly closely aligned. But over the period of time, we've also seen the federal regulator look at enhancing their standards. So you're seeing convergence happening there too. And over time, I would imagine that the level of integration between the different regulators will come about. There are differences, and I think that's important to bear in mind. I mean, particularly around capital requirements and conduct of business, and then the actual approach, the regulatory approach of the regulator. So within the DIFC, the DFSA is very approachable. Firms can have meetings, they can call up their supervisor, have a discussion. It's not the same across the board. So again, areas that merit due consideration and an element of investigation.
Okay, got it. Interesting. It sounds as though it's very dynamic. No question there. So I guess to Claire, then, could you give us a bit of an overview about what's involved in setting up an office in the DIFC for a fund manager who's looking to do so? Now, are there things like minimum substance requirements that we may see in other jurisdictions, and need to have people on the ground or other formalities?
That is indeed correct. You do need to have substance on the ground. There are no brass plate entities that are allowed. So one of the first things that we always talk to firms about is, well, what is it you're looking to set up? And there are a couple of things that come into play right at the very beginning. One is, what kind of regulatory license do you need? And the second is, what kind of corporate structure are you going to put in place? So taking the latter first, there is the option to set up a branch entity into the DIFC, or you can set up a subsidiary. So you can start to ring fence your subsidiary, and rather than have it as the same legal entity as, say, giving an example of your UK parent or your US parent firm. So if you do go the branch route, it has to be the branch of a regulated entity in a recognised jurisdiction. And some firms like that because it is the same legal entity from a papering perspective. And also it means that you don't have to have separate capital requirements in that particular entity. So some firms like going that route. But the more popular route, if I'm honest, is the subsidiary. And this is setting up a separate legal entity. And in that legal entity, you will need to have, whether this is a branch or a subsidiary, you would need to have a local senior executive officer, or SEO as we call them. That person does have to be ordinarily resident in the UAE and will be responsible for the regulation or the management of the regulatory obligations of that entity in the DIFC. Along with that, you will also need to have a compliance officer and a money laundering reporting officer. That can be the same person providing both roles, and it can also be outsourced, but it has to be a person that, once again, is ordinarily resident in the UAE. Although there are sometimes some exemptions that are given if there's a strong group compliance officer with local support. The other mandatory functions are finance officer. They can also be outsourced and they don't need to be ordinarily resident. And then also for the subsidiary, they need directors. Usually we say three directors. One should usually be your executive director, which is normally your senior executive officer. And then two non-execs, not necessarily independent, so they can actually come from within your group. The second question then is, what is it you're actually trying to do with this entity? What services are you offering? And this will then determine the category of license required. So for asset managers in particular, there's really two categories of license. One is what we call a Category 4 license, which is very much your arranging advising license. So this really does go to your sort of marketing type operations, where you have someone there in the region who is reaching out to people and arranging for them to make investments in your fund, potentially providing advice on which funds to make those investments into, but generally going out to find potential investors. Then we also have the Category 3C, and this really does go more to your asset managers. So these are the people, like Ali was saying, that the portfolio managers that are coming to the region. Now, some of them will also do the arranging and advising side, and that can be done under the 3C license as well. But the additional thing under the 3C license is you can manage assets. And you can also manage a collective investment scheme. So this is the equivalent of sort of an operator or a GP that we might come to understand, where they actually can set up the actual fund structure themselves, rather than just being, if you will, the asset manager or portfolio manager. So those tend to be the specific questions. And then depending on the answer as to the application that's made, but the mandatory functions remain the same in both types of licenses. The other thing to bring up, which has happened in the last few years, is the requirement around economic substance. So when we do have directors on a board, we normally make sure that at least two of those board meetings are held within the UAE to meet those economic substance requirements. And as a branch, we generally have sort of either a management committee or something similar, which once again has to hold meetings so as they can show and demonstrate that decisions are made within the country and therefore have that economic substance that's required. And of course, a lot of this does revolve around sort of tax obligations and things. So it's important to really be thinking about how you structure your firm and what exactly that firm is going to do to really understand who you need, how often they need to be in the region, and also, you know, what kind of license do they actually need. The Category 3C is generally seen as the higher of the standards, as you can imagine, and therefore it has slightly more oversight and, of course, more capital implications as well.
Okay, so it sounds like there are some licensing requirements then, which is helpful to know. I guess just to drive one point home in particular, are there sort of specific rules around, you know, what if the office wants to conduct marketing in the UAE and more broadly in the Middle East? Could you just sort of close the loop on that?
Yeah, so the marketing side is the license allows you to do business in or from. So if it is your marketing throughout the Middle East, then of course you can do that under the Category 4 license. As we were sort of saying, with the interplay with the other regulators and of course the other jurisdictions further afield than even the UAE, you then need to be very conscious of the regulatory requirements in those jurisdictions. Some firms actually do have quite a lot of investor meetings within the DIFC, for instance, where they actually hold their license. And of course, the license then covers you to do everything that you need in the DIFC. Equally, if you're flying off to Saudi or Qatar, you need to really be thinking, as Ali says, about, you know, making sure you understand your regulatory obligations. Other than obviously regulatory risk, you of course have that commercial risk that if you did market to somebody in a jurisdiction where you required a license, for instance, and you didn't have such a license, there is always the potential that the client can turn around and ask for their money back. So that tends to focus clients' mind on making sure they understand the requirements in each of the jurisdiction. And as I say, reverse solicitation is still an option for people to actually benefit from. So that is also something that people look at papering within their sort of firms in the financial free zones.
Yeah. And Claire, you mentioned a number of mandatory rules that a DIFC office needs to maintain. So can any of these be outsourced, or does it require sort of sending people over or hiring local people that only work for you?
Yeah, some certainly can be outsourced. The compliance officer and MLRO role is one of those areas. Although, obviously, as Ali has said, you know, the DIFC has been around now for 20 years. Yet, you know, we still find that the level of complexity and the depth of people in these offices, sometimes you can only have like two or three people based in the office. And therefore, something like a full-time compliance officer might not be necessary, especially when they're supported at sort of a group level. So the regulator, and this once again goes back to Ali's point, you know, has been very pragmatic and understood the nuances of the region, that there's not hundreds of compliance officers available for very small firms. So they do allow you to outsource that compliance officer and MLRO function to a local provider. Equally, once again, being very pragmatic, from the finance officer perspective, you know, they can also be outsourced to an external third party, or they can actually be outsourced to the finance team, perhaps that sits in the group. Whether that be the UK, the US, or elsewhere. So you have those kind of options. So it does give a bit of flexibility. The senior executive officer is probably the key that does need to be internal and does need to be ordinarily resident. And equally, we've had recent conversations with people about setting up in the DIFC as well as maybe the ADGM. And just to be clear, that it's there is restrictions on people double hatting. So if you do set up a couple of entities in the UAE, then you also need to be aware that you do need to staff up each of those entities, particularly with the senior executive officer. But you don't necessarily need many more people than that actually within the entity there.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Claire. For my final question on this topic, what about alternatives to getting a license? Are there such thing as regulatory hosts that will put your employees on their books and let you use their license to conduct activities in the DIFC?
Anna, this is a really interesting question right now, and it's definitely one that that we've seen a lot of interest in from both clients and regulators. So in answer to your question, there are some firms that provide something similar to a hosting environment that we've seen in the UK, but not in a regulatory environment that's really set up for that type of operation. So it's happening, but it's not happening in a way that we would understand, as we have done from a UK perspective, where there are specific regulations and there's a specific regulatory understanding of how those kind of relationships work. Nevertheless, I think that this is an area where, as Ali has said, you know, we've now seen, let's say, hedge funds that have been coming in and setting up over the last couple of years. You know, you'll start to see that there will be some people that will roll out of those hedge funds or those asset managers setting up their own. And it can be quite daunting to try and set up a whole entity on your own without an infrastructure like a hosting platform. So I think this is an area that will probably be developed in time. And it's also looking at the DIFC and some of those nuances and differences that are coming out as business is developing. We have seen DIFC and DFSA having now the ability to have what's called operating a fund platform added to licenses. And this actually is something that firms have only just started to wake up to, which is actually an interesting development where someone can actually have a license to set up separate funds under their platform, which are managed by different managers. So it's a concept that's getting some traction, and there has been some movement, but not to the same extent as we've perhaps seen in the UK in that kind of hosting environment.
Well, thank you. I think that brings us to another subject. Jake, over to you.
Yeah. So, you know, I guess going away from the fund manager itself and now more towards the funds, you know, Ali, what would you say is sort of the local GCC, broader Middle East investor demand for use of DIFC? You know, we've seen a number of fund managers, whether or not they're located in the UAE, to establishing UAE feeders for their funds. Could you give us a bit more intel on that trend? You know, what are its origins? What are you seeing from the DIFC?
Yes, thank you, Jake. Yeah, interesting question. Actually, we have seen a record number of funds domiciled in DIFC in 2023, with now over 200 such funds registered in the jurisdiction. And I think you can put this down to three main drivers. Firstly, I think we've reached that level of comfort from firms and investors in relation to the maturity and the operation of the jurisdiction. Secondly, I think there is a desire, there has been a growing desire for firms to offer local products, particularly for regional investments. And I think that's tied in to the economic development we're seeing in the region and the growth in investable assets. So that's been driving domiciliation of funds in relation to private equity, for example, venture capital and real estate. And then thirdly, actually it's been a recent response to fund marketing rules issued by the federal regulator, the Securities and Commodities Authority, who has set out that any funds marketed to retail must be a UAE domiciled fund. And the ESCA have recognized DIFC funds as being a UAE fund for those purposes. So it's actually, it's quite, you know, it's a really good example of how the different regulatory bodies can collaborate. And that is why, you know, we're seeing a number of global asset managers, very large houses, as well as you know, smaller ones, but you know, the larger houses that have been active in the region for quite some time are now saying, actually, yeah, the way we can, you know, access retail in the UAE makes a lot of sense to have a feeder fund in the DIFC. It's recognized as a UAE fund. We're very happy with the jurisdiction. And then have investors, you know, subscribe to those funds. So that's, you know, definitely an area of growth. And I think we're probably going to see that continue very much in 2024.
Well, we did talk a lot about the benefits of setting up in DIFC. What do you think are the downsides of DIFC as compared to some of the other UAE jurisdictions?
Oh, that's a very difficult question, Anna. I'm not sure I can identify any downsides. You know, listen, I mean, you know, as I've mentioned, the DIFC has been around now for 20 years. You know, if I was an asset manager, let's put it this way. If I was a global asset manager, I'd definitely be looking at the region, you know, given, you know, the economic developments that we're seeing, given the large, significant asset pools, both institutional and private, and given the emergence of Dubai in particular as an alternative hub for Asia, and, you know, whether it's political stability, whether it's the visa-friendly approach of the UAE compared to other jurisdictions, all of that would compel me to consider having a local presence in the region. And then when you sort of, you know, start off with that high level concept, you think, okay, you know, that makes sense. You know, where else, you know, where should I be? Then the DIFC, you know, stands out as an obvious choice for consideration. It has the greatest substance as a financial center. It's got the longest track record. The laws and regs have been tried and tested. And Dubai as a city is, you know, the acknowledged global commercial hub of the region. So I think the question really is, you know, should I be looking at the Middle East? And I think the answer is definitely yes.
Well, that's certainly great to hear. Thank you, Ali. And now more of a question, you know, something that comes up for any fund manager when they're looking to set up a new office or really just interact with any jurisdiction they haven't before, for both you, Ali and Claire, you know, are there any forthcoming changes or things that a fund manager should be aware of in terms of tax laws or upcoming or new tax rules in the UAE or DIFC at large?
Yeah, perhaps I can give some insights into the direction of travel. So the UAE, as a sovereign country, supported pretty much by the recommendations of international bodies like the IMF, has been looking at bringing a certain level of maturity, if you like, to its taxation system, and particularly to avoid being identified with the more negative perceptions, if you like, of an offshore tax haven, which it isn't seeking to do. So as well as adopting a VAT regime at 5%, which was implemented recently, the UAE has put in place a corporate tax rate of 9%. However, at the same time, the country as a whole is very mindful of maintaining its competitiveness and also to allow industries such as financial services to develop further. So to that end, the first level of comfort for asset managers, if you like, is that free zones can continue to offer their tax incentives. So the DIFC has a 0% corporate tax, 0% income tax rate guaranteed for 50 years from 2004 and thereafter renewable. The federal corporate tax, a second level of comfort, if you like, only applies to revenue that's generated from the UAE markets. And then the third, and probably the most important level of comfort for an asset manager, is that investment management activities are altogether exempt. So you have various levels of protection, if you like, as an asset management firm. And so I think in summary, investment management firms will continue to experience significant tax benefits of being based in the DIFC and indeed, you know, in the wider UAE.
Thank you. Thank you both for sharing valuable insights and market intelligence with us today. that concludes our podcast, and I'm sure we will be speaking to you all again very soon.